I'm a maid who would marry and will take with no qualm any Tom, Dick, or Harry, any Harry, Dick, or Tom. I'm a maid mad to marry and will take double quick any Tom, Dick, or Harry, any Tom, Harry, or Dick. Any Tom, Dick, or Harry, any Tom, Harry, or Dick.
I take a dick. It's ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez.
And I am Drea Clark.
And we are back. We're back very quickly because we wanted to get back on schedule and we didn't want to end January without honoring TCM Star of the Month, which is Catherine Grayson. So we are going to be talking about 1953's Kiss Me, Kate. We could have done a lot of Catherine Grayson movies, but I feel like this might be sacrilegious to say, all of Catherine Grayson's movies seem the same. They're all musicals where she just plays the woman who doesn't want to fall for the cocky male, but she does anyway. What's your background with Catherine Grayson prior to us saying we were going to do Kiss Me, Kate?
Well, it was knowing her as the woman who doesn't want to fall for the snarky guy. Yeah, I have seen Anchors Away about 1,000 times, and I don't know why, because I don't think it's particularly good. I put that phrasing in so I can give myself an escape route because I have seen it so many times, but I think it's kind of messy, and yet I still love it. I find it so charming. Is it Showboat that she did?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I was familiar with her in those things. I remember her standing out to me as a performer because it is very clear when she starts singing that she's trained in opera, not just in musical theater style singing. Her voice, her singing voice, is so different from a lot of performers of that era when they were doing a ton of musicals, because, you know, operatic voice isn't always as accessible. It's very noticeable vibrato, and it's just trained in a different way. So that stood out to me. And also, she has a really powerful voice, and she's this really small person. So I always kind of liked that mixture in her. I know her primarily from a few key roles, but as you know, I had not seen Kiss Me, Kate, and I do not know how I hadn't.
Yeah, my experience with Catherine Grayson is probably about on par with yours. I've seen Anchors Away, and I will agree with you. Anchors Away, I think, is one good moment with Gary. Yes. That's about it. It's not as good as On the Town.
No,
it's just Discount on the
Town.
And then I've seen Showboat, which is not nearly as good as the 30s version, I think, is the one with James Whale that he directed. And then I've seen this one. And she only did 26 movies. I think this was her second to last film that she starred in before she segued into television. So I'm not a huge fan of hers, but I think Kiss Me, Kate is her best role. And when I was researching her, I realized that Catherine Grayson is not actually her name. She has a really great original name in reality. Can you guess what it is, Drea?
You're saying it in a way that's telling me it's not just her last name that's changed. So she probably has some crazy first name.
Yes.
That I have no idea.
Her first name was Zelma.
Zelma?
Zelma.
So there's one person who had that name ever. Good to know.
She was born Zelma Hedrick.
Weren't we all, Kristen? Weren't we all?
I just think that is amazing.
There's definitely days when I feel like a real Zelma Hedrick.
That's going to be our new catchphrase, our new thing when, like, we can't have anything. We're just going to be like, aw, Zelma.
Exactly.
But she was originally supposed to be a replacement for Deanna Durbin, because Deanna Durbin left Universal and Metro brought her on as the replacement. So she went through all these coaching and voice lessons and, of course, diets and exercise.
Oh, I was just going to say, and then they, like, whittled her down. She's real tiny in this film.
And this movie is all about her eating and having gas. To be very weird. And she ended up making three films in 1942 alone. And from there, it was just, she was just on. And she usually played, yes, sweet women who kind of had this fieriness to them. Usually in musical romantic comedies. She's really uncontroversial. I don't think that Catherine Grayson is remembered, and I hate to say this, because she just wasn't that messy. And I hate to say that. I feel like the actresses that get remembered are the ones that just had really, really horrible lives.
Well, that's good. It makes me think maybe she had a nice, solid life, which seems to be a rarity, and I'm glad for her if that's the case. Even the name, I think I had to kind of cast my head, because, you know, you think of the films like the ones we've mentioned, and actually I think I saw another one called, I want to say Seven Sisters, but I know I'm thinking
Seven Sweethearts.
Oh, okay. I was like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Brides,
Seven Mice. So many, yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Seven Sweethearts. Yeah, I saw her in that, and it's something about like tulips, and I remember her as like a period piece. Like, yeah, but again, the very sweet demeanor. She is strangely not that she's not memorable, but that she hasn't made a mark in film history in the same way that other women who've she starred in, it may have been a short line of roles, but against big names, her collaborations, it's not like she was doing these small unnoticed films. So it is interesting. And I do hope, like you're saying, it's for the reasons that she had a decent background.
I will say the messiest thing about her life, according to Esther Williams, my girl Esther Williams, who wrote in her 1999 autobiography, which again, if you have not read it, you should, because Esther spilled the tea on everybody and it's great. But she talked about how while she was making the film This Time for Keeps with Johnny Johnston, who was Catherine Grayson's second husband, that Johnny Johnston would read the letters that Catherine Grayson wrote to him to the girls in his fan club, including, quote, the all too graphic details concerning what she liked about his lovemaking.
That asshole! While they were married?
I know. Apparently, yes, while they were married.
Well, that's really debunking my hopes that she had some smooth sailing. Don't marry actors! Like, it's rule number one, ladies, do not marry actors.
It's very, very true. And I think this movie proves why you don't marry actors.
Exactly.
Because everybody in Kiss Me, Kate is lovingly horrible in their own way. But are they? Is it Shakespeare that's horrible, or is it these characters? Is the immortal question.
It is. Second fun fact, I do not know how it escaped my notice. I had no idea that this film was a variation of The Taming of the Shrew. No clue.
I know.
It's clearly a very big blind spot in my film history, but it also was made me excited to realize finally a connection between Kiss Me, Kate and 10 Things I Hate About You, something yes. I've been looking for forever. I love Shakespeare, and it is absolutely his most problematic work. And I'm including like The Merchant of Venice, things that are possibly anti-Semitic. Taming of the Shrew and its inherent misogyny. I mean, the title alone is just red flag central. And so me being like, oh, well, this can't possibly go wrong in the guise of what year is this? Like
1953.
1953 musical romantic comedy. I'm sure they are going to just sidestep neatly over all of the... No, they're not. He's going to spank her on stage. Repeatedly.
I will say, though, there are a lot of movies in the classic era that involve spanking a woman.
Oh, my God.
And I think now as an adult, I find that I have a real double-edged sword attraction to it.
Because
I'm like, this is so terrible. But at the same time, I was like, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm pretty sure that if this was an R-rated movie, This would be leading into something really weird.
And it would not surprise me to discover a deep-seated tinge of S&M interest that was sparked by all of these films. The Taming of the Shrew has an interesting framing device that's equally a little both out of the story and kind of a meta-observation. So when this film started, and the first thing on screen is a prop that says, "Kiss Me, Kate" by Cole Porter, and then someone picks it up, and it's an actor playing Cole Porter, I was like, am I on drugs? What is going on? This is insane. Yes, there was a lot of, wait, what? That's not, I had to pause, and I was like, that's not Cole Porter. And then I had to look it up and be like, no, it's, I'm right. Not. Okay, good. I'm not totally crazy.
It's Ron Randell is the actor who plays Cole, the greatest Cole Porter in movie history.
He does do a great job. It's a very funny, it took me a second to figure out, oh, there's sort of a self-referential musical within a musical. Okay, now I'm going. I've hit the ground running. Good. And then once Ann Miller got there, I was like, all right, I'm in. Dance it up.
We'll mention the plot really briefly before we get too into it. So the plot involves two actors, Fred Graham, played by Howard Keel, and Lily Vanessi, played by Catherine Grayson. They are ex-lovers. Full disclosure, I did not revisit the movie last night because I saw it about a month and a half ago. So it is fresh, but not steaming fresh. So they are a divorced couple. She goes over to his house to hang out with him and Cole Porter, where they are doing a musical adaptation of The Taming of the Shrew called Kiss Me, Kate, to be directed by Fred. But Lily does not want to make this movie. So Fred, doing one of many dickish things that he does in this entire movie, brings over his gal pal, who's literally named Lois Lane, played by Ann Miller. She has come to audition for the role of Bianca in the play. And that's where she performs the legendary Too Darn Hot number. Lily is against being the lead, Catherine, opposite Fred, but because she wants to go marry this rich Texas rancher.
Who's named Tex.
Who is literally named Tex and who can only talk about meat. So she changes her mind, though, when essentially Fred and Cole say, well, you know, Lois could play that role. It's the old reverse psychology on women. So she says, no, I'm going to play this role. So then we cut to the actual performance of the show Kiss Me, Kate. They're doing the behind the stage stuff, prepping for the big night. You find out that Lois actually has a boyfriend, Bill, played by that dreamboat of mine, Tommy Rahl. I love him in this movie, who is also a scumbag.
He's great. And
she's essentially dating Fred to get Bill a part in the show. But Bill has put Fred's name on his gambling debts. Of course, there's going to be two mob guys that show up looking to collect. Opening night happens, and the rest of the movie is told on stage with the actors playing the characters, but the play also mimics their own relationship? Question mark? I think I've hit everything.
Yes, you did really well. There's a lot going on here.
There's a lot going on in a movie that's 109 minutes. TCM Classic Film Festival showed this 3 years ago, I think it was. They did it in 3D. Because 1953 is considered the year of 3D. Every movie that was released at that point wanted to do 3D. And so we got to watch it with the 3D glasses, which was really cool. But I had never seen it. It was not the movie that I was planning to go see that day. And so I went with two of my friends, and we're sitting there, and we're watching this movie. And I'm not really sure where we lost it and said we loved it. If it was when Howard Keel shows up looking like a guy-linered, codpiece rocking gay porn star, when he's in his Petruchio outfit, or if it was Ann Miller's performance of Every Tom, Dick, and Harry, where she starts singing A Dick, A Dick. I don't know where we lost it. At a certain point, we were howling in this movie. We were like, this is the best thing ever. What is this film? This is a serious movie that people watched because they knew it was a rom-com. This movie is a romance, yes, but the comedy... The comedy is just so good.
Both intentional and unintentional.
There's so much unintentional comedy. It is so not cool. But what was your first time watching this like? I mean, I know you talked about Ann Miller kind of sold you, but at a certain point, where were you just like, how did this get made? Like, that's what I said, what I say about this movie all the time. How did this get past all of the censors in 53?
I knew from the framing device, one of the elements with musicals is how do we integrate the musical sequences? It's right. Either we make it a stage show, which is the majority of this, but they break into song in real life. So the, you know, the kind of the two of them, Catherine and Howard Keel, them sort of reigniting the remembrance of their love. They have this song called Wonder Bar that they just sing a full out song and dance in their dressing room. So there's that weird thing with musicals where you're like, oh, this is either a world where people break into song and dance, which is what this world is, or it's, you know, sort of more organically threaded in. And when Ann Miller rolled in and not just performed a song to all of them with like gusto and tapped her little heart out, she's so talented, I love her so much, but she also rolled in with like an 8-piece band.
She pulls out an 8-piece band and she's all dressed in this little leggy bangly outfit like she just came from the Copa or
she
something.
Literally was like, I'm on break from the Copa. So they took the time to write in why she was wearing this preposterous outfit, and they never explained how she has an 8-piece band in matching burgundy, almost mariachi looking suits, but it's like a jazz band. They just roll into this dude's living room.
And she starts dancing on the coffee table.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, I love how she's throwing hair bands and scarves at the camera, but it's also being thrown at the characters sitting down on the couch. And you know everything you need to know about these characters with this dance number, because you watch Howard Keel just sitting there with this big grin on his face. And then you see Lily, Catherine Grayson, when she gets thrown the scarf, she just, or the garter, she just like throws it on the floor like it's got an STD on it or something.
Yeah.
She's so disgusted. And the musical was actually inspired. This was an adaptation of a Broadway show written by Dorothy Kingsley, but based on the Broadway show Kiss Me, Kate, which is, the book is actually by Samuel and Bella Spiewak. And it was based on the real battles between husband and wife, Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine, when they were doing a 1935 production of Taming of the Shrew.
Wow. Layers upon layers.
This is essentially a biopic.
You know, a lot of couples have famously played Beatrice and Benedict from Much Ado About Nothing. That I can get behind. If I was in a couple with another actor, I'd be like, we are absolutely not doing Taming of the Shrew. I thank you, sir.
Taming of the Shrew is one of Shakespeare's most misogynist plays.
For sure.
It's terrible. And so a lot of movies have had to really soften how the play is. And I love that this movie doesn't do that. It doesn't do that at all.
No, it doesn't at all. Pretty much. It almost accelerates it. So it's like you mentioned, the ridiculous reverse psychology of how they entice Catherine Grayson's character to play this role is by, she sort of storms out and is like, I said good day, sir. And then she leaves, and then, you know, they know she's still in earshot, so they're like, oh, Lois can play it. Lois can be the lead. And then she storms back in and is like, absolutely not, I'm the lead. And you're like, oh, okay.
The whole competition between Lois and Lily kind of goes nowhere by the end of the movie. It's really built up, like, once they're doing the actual, like, dress rehearsal, and they're like, and we take our bows. Lily has this nice, uncomfortable-looking curtsy that she does. And Ann Miller just lifts her skirt up and starts showing her legs. I mean, if you knew Ann Miller at that time, what she was known for, and the fact that she was considered Louis B's lady love.
Right.
It's hard not to watch this movie as a really inside look at Hollywood and how Fred being Louis B and Lily being every poor, you know, A-list actress that didn't sleep with him, and poor Lois is Ann Miller, who is just an opportunist, who is essentially Ann Miller. I don't know if that's intentional, but it comes through that way. Once they actually start performing the play, which once it gets going, there is no real blurring. The lines between on stage and off stage are very blurred. You know, they start singing, we open in Venice on this treadmill, which is really great. And again, the costumes in this movie are bananas.
They are so incredible. The tightest costumes I've ever seen of this era for both genders.
I make fun of Howard Keel a lot because he always starred as these big strapping men. He was in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. And he's got this just big booming voice, but he always is a guy that I feel, quote unquote, likes to peacock. And so everything in this movie is, let me lift my leg up. Let me just be standing here with my leg caught in the air. Why? I don't know. It looks uncomfortable, but I'm going to do it. I will not stress this any more than I have to, but his codpiece is just... thank God this movie is in 3D. I mean, or we don't have 3D, because it's literally dangerous to your
health. It's ridiculous, yeah.
They put him in these jumpsuits with, like, one arm, and he's got so much guyliner on him that he makes Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean look underdone. It's just crazy. And then he's complimented by Lily, who's in these really form-fitting long gowns, and then Ann Miller has cutouts in her so that she can swing her legs all around.
Of course.
It is a hodgepodge of styles, none of which were in Shakespeare's time, historically inaccurate.
That's the amazing part of it, is the stage costumes. And they actually even show, like, one of the things to entice Lily in the very beginning is they show her sketches of the costumes they have intended for the stage later.
The mom guys show up.
Oh,
Fred trots out the dress for the third act, the wedding gown. He says, look, isn't this beautiful? And the mob guys are telling Lily, you know, yeah, you look really good in this. You should put it on. And you're just feeling really threatened right now.
Well, yeah, they're holding a gun on her when that happened. Backing up just a little in the story of it, you mentioned Ann Miller's initial, like, the dance, Too Darn Hot, at the very beginning. I will say where I just fully was like, I'm in it. There is something to the quality that Ann Miller brings, how Lily and Lois treat each other. I actually was grateful for, because there's not any genuine animosity between the two of them. There's not a real competitiveness, because you almost immediately discover that Lois is actually in love with this other guy who's a chorus singer and a poor gambler. Subterfuge on her part in how she's kind of leading on Keel's character, which I liked, because I think if there had been a whole other thread of women fighting over a man or behaving in a petty manner with each other, it would have been too much. I couldn't have enjoyed the ridiculousness, because there is enough misogyny and strange hierarchy and power choices between the men and women. So I was actually very grateful for the Lois character. Seemed completely open to Lily from the word go. It's never the side eyes. There's a little sneakiness when they're talking about the curtsying, but it's almost more of a professional challenge. That angle of it, it helped balance the ship a bit for me.
I agree with that. And I think, too, this movie really relies on the dance and the music more than the actual story. And the dancing here is really phenomenal. Ann Miller, obviously, who had the fastest taps in the world, and I can believe that. But then you have that scene she has with Tommy Rawl, the Why Don't You Behave number, where he's just on trampolines and jumping all around, and again, you get that 3D effect of, like, oh, he's gonna fall into the audience. I wish. But there's a lot of acrobatic, it shows you the skill, I think, that actors and dancers had to have in this time period. We make fun now of modern day musicals because you don't need to be a dancer anymore to do it. They just give you an Oscar for it, Damien Chazelle. But back in the day, I mean, you are watching these guys jump around and dance, and it is seriously a feat of athleticism, which I think is fantastic. Of course, you get the Fosse number in this movie. You can tell it's Fosse right off the bat. The choreography is attributed to Hermes Pan, but as soon as you get the hands outstretched and the wobbly knees, you're like, oh, we're watching Fosse right now, aren't we? Fosse did acting. He acted in several films. If you want to see him actually have a character, go watch him in the remake of My Sister Eileen. He's not the best actor. wasn't the most attractive guy, but he's really good in this dance scene that makes little sense in the context of the movie. It's just, we got Fosse. He won't leave us alone unless we let him dance for a couple of minutes. So I think it works.
I enjoyed it. And the dancing overall, it is something whenever I go back to any of these films, dual level of appreciation. One is, as you mentioned, what the actors and dancers are bringing to the table. For instance, the rooftop scene with your boyfriend, Tommy Rahl. In watching that, it immediately came to mind. I got a very Franco vibe from his smirk and his whole demeanor. Even before he starts dancing, I'm like, oh, I know who this guy is. He's arrived in a cab that he hasn't paid for, and his girlfriend Lois has to go
that
out and pay for it.
Flinty eyes.
She pays for it, and then he kind of, you know, swoons at her, and then she sort of forgives him. And so even before he started dancing, there's a character built. I know who this guy is. He's like oozing with charm. And so his performance was great. Then they get on the rooftop, because I've already seen her blow it out of the water. I know this girl can dance. And then, oh, he can keep up. Oh, he's bouncing. Like, there is something. My immediate thought, especially since I'd already made the Franco comparison, was, man, they had to be able to do so much more back then to make an impact, to make a career. The idea of having that voice and being able to dance like that and act. We make a lot of triple threat references a lot here. And a lot of the people credited with being like, oh, they're a good singer. I'm like, sure, they're like the best singer in your high school. They're not amazing performers. And again, it's because of the industry. There's not a huge demand for people with musical theater chops. I wish we did have more musicals. I'm in that world. A lot of people don't like them. There was something about the skill level that's coming forth. The other side of that was how they filmed those. I think it's Gene Kelly that talks about the importance of filming dance sequences from the whole body, because choreographers, for the most part, and actually Fosse mixed this up when he was directing, but choreographers traditionally, like in the 50s, were thinking of a performance like how an audience in the theater would see it, like a stage audience. So it's a full body action, and therefore the camera is always far enough back that you see all the movement, and you get even more appreciation of how they're moving within each other, how each, you know, how the hands and the feet and how the whole body looks moving. Where we are now, after decades of music video close-ups and quick cuts, we don't see movement in the same way anymore. And it's another way you can sort of cheat around if you're not that strong a performer. So I loved being embraced in that. I love when I watch that and I'm like, ugh, these people know what they're doing as dancers, and the camera knows what it's doing and backs its ass up so I can see the whole thing.
You're onto something too when you brought up that actors had to do more than just act. You know, we talked about Catherine Grayson at the beginning, that she went through all these lessons. It wasn't just enough that she was a coloratura soprano who could sing opera. They also gave her acting lessons. A lot of stars back then took diction lessons, which is why you get a lot of the enunciating actors that they make fun of in something like Singing in the Rain, round tunes, stuff like that. They also took dance and singing lessons. It helped if you were a professional dancer, but everybody was trained. And so if you were a professional dancer, it just made your dancing all the sharper. And so I think that that's what we've really lost, is that now the industry is purely about aesthetics and acting ability first and foremost. If you can do anything else, that's great. But I think when we talked about Esther Williams in the On an Island with You episode, I think I said this then, you're not going to get a person who is not known for acting to be a big star anymore. You know, back in the day when you got Esther Williams, who was a swimmer, that was her thing. They turned her into an actress. Sonya Henie was an ice skater that they turned into an act. I know LeBron James has dabbled with acting, but they're not definitely making him an actor. You know, it's why sports stars nowadays don't turn into A-list stars, because there's not that
training. Well, they can't all make cinematic masterpieces like Space Jam. There's only so many Space Jams.
Very, very true. Kiss Me, Kate, I think, once we get into the actual performance of the play. So you brought up the Wunderbar number, which I think is a great number, but it is a bit undone with the weird comedic points. The great moment being that Lily is not allowed to eat before they do the play because she gets stomach pain.
Not just stomach pain, he says indigestion, and it was one of those things, like, I always like looking back both at the official code or the Hays code, like any of those, but also what the censors were allowing through, and I'm like, they weren't allowed to say the word pregnant on television, but we right. are having an entire sequence about this woman's indigestion. So that sequence was another thing. That's in Taming of the Shrew. One of the ways that Petruchio overpowers her is he starts to control her eating and what she can eat. And it's, again, another thing that's always bugged me greatly. And so that was an interesting way to filter that through, because it's not them in character when he's doing that. It's mirroring the actual Taming of the Shrew with the quote unquote real life moments of Kiss Me, Kate. So I appreciated it for the adaptation trickery, but also F that noise. The idea of a man sending away a woman's meal, oh, that's just red flag central.
See, I'm glad you brought up that it was connected to the play, because I just went for a medical reason. So I was sitting there thinking, does she have like a bowel problem or something that's going to happen on stage? I'm not understanding. I'm thinking about her like vomiting or something at a certain point.
That's true. Oh, you know, you have this horrible history of upchucking on stage, so
or worse. Yeah, or I was worse, like, is she exactly. gonna ruin something? I don't understand. So they have this weird thing where he's controlling what she's eating, and she says, oh, she's gonna have a whoops. That's again, I'm telling you, I thought that we were gonna have to have a mop and a bucket at a certain point on this stage performance. But then they start the play, and they're in their little Santa suits on the treadmill, which again, cod pieces are everywhere, and it's very distracting.
It is no joke, yeah.
You have Ann Miller perform the song Any Tom, Dick, or Harry.
I would go back to the treadmill real briefly, because when that came up, I was like, oh, this is wonderful. This is wonderful staging. It made me think of, obviously, there was that very famous OK Go video, music video from a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, on treadmills. That's right.
And I'm actually friends with the woman who directed that. And I know she's a huge musicals fan. And so now I should ask her if she had seen or been thinking of Kiss Me, Kate. They obviously use them very differently in the OK Go video. But one of the things with the treadmill, and then they have this kind of like rotating screen behind it, because they're explaining the cities they're going through. They're like Padua, Verona, whatever. And
in Venice. And
yeah, they're like they're setting the scene in fair Verona, where we lay our scene, but not. Actually, that right away, it was a double thing of, oh, the staging of this is pretty incredible. And it is funny because the whole, as you mentioned, the major thrust of it, especially from the second act onward, takes place on stage during the actual stage show. But if you looked at a diagram of the stage, like it would never translate any of it to an audience. They're like 100 yards back at times. The set pieces are insane. It's a really nice blending of, oh, we want this to convey the idea that these are set pieces and we're doing a stage show, but we want it to be really cinematic. And I hadn't known this was shot in 3D, though you saying 1953 does make sense for that. It illuminates a lot of how this was shot. I was very impressed throughout with how far they went with the staging and making every single setup as unique or interesting as possible, be that if it's a large space, or sometimes they did great things of putting a lot of actors in a small space and then having something revealed, like when the two bad guys are in costume and they're like playing cards behind a scrim and the scrim gets knocked over and it's nice and comedic. But that treadmill was a great way of introducing me to the idea of, oh, they're doing this as a stage show, but they want you to understand that it's a big deal. This isn't just, oh, we're treading the boards and minimalism and stripped down. This is, oh no, they're doing really inventive things. So I really liked that little treadmill moment. And it also makes me understand why Sweet Catherine Grayson would have needed some extra training, because even just the treadmill stuff, she was the only one out of the four of them that I swear I could see her like counting the steps. She was not the most natural of movers.
Well, and you bring up a good point, which is that the stage here looks incredibly gigantic.
When they're
actually doing all the stuff and performing, the stage looks about three times the size of what it should be. And then when they pan out to the audience and you see how small it is, you're thinking movie magic, because there is way more going on. But I do love the treadmill because it conveys the concept of distance. And then it leads into the actual story. I think the rest of the movie integrates stage techniques very well, but I don't think it ever gets as inventive as that.
That was the pinnacle of it in terms of playful. Like, if they had done things with sort of revolving sets, or it would have kept up with it, but that was the most inventive use. And it's probably because it's the only stage piece that was very clearly created with a specific musical number in mind. The rest of them look like the musical numbers were fit into a stage piece.
Well, and that brings us to the Tom, Dick, and Harry number, because I think that's the high point of the movie's insanity. I don't stress that enough. It is insane. Lois, as Bianca, is conveying to the audience about the fact that she has three suitors, but she can't marry them until the eldest daughter, Catherine, played by Lily, is married. And so she has these three suitors, and each of them wants to win them over, but she'll literally marry anyone. That's the point. Any Tom, Dick, or Harry. And then it turns into Ann Miller tap dancing, singing about Dick.
No.
I'm not kidding. There is a slew of lines about it. And it is where I think the movie goes for broke. It says, hey, we know that this is insane, but we're just going to keep going forward.
It's so egregious that I almost wanted to look up, when did Dick become a slang for not private detective? Because the second that song started, and she starts, Tom, Dick, and Harry is the standard way of the listing of those names. And then as soon as she started saying the names in different order, I was like, where is this going? What's happening? The structure of it is that she and Catherine, her older sister, aka the Kate of Kiss Me Kate, are being raised by this father. And this is the Taming of the Shrew, not the Kiss Me Kate synopsis, which you already did, the Taming of the Shrew synopsis, that they're being raised by this very controlling older father. And Bianca is just lovely life of the party, and many men are in love with her, and she's desperate to get out there and experience that Tom, Dick, and Harry. She's being held back because the father won't let her marry until her older sister does. And her older sister famously has her big torch song is called I Hate Men, which the fact that this is a musical that has a song called I Hate Men, and that is actually an example of how misogynistic it is. I'm like, this, oh my gosh, the gender politics of this are a mess. Like, the idea of this woman who's earned this revile, she's this controlling father, she is mistreated, the man that she ultimately like falls for is controlling to the point of choosing what she can eat or not. And that we are supposed to laugh at her singing about how she hates men and how that makes her a bad person. I'm like, no, she earned that. That's fair. That song makes sense to me. If I was her, that's the only song I'd sing.
I Hate Men is a song that is just, I think, gotten more prescient as time has gone on. And the lyrics are incredibly relatable to women, where she talks about something about how the husband's making time with his pretty secretary, all these things about how men suck. I was just thinking, this is relevant. This may be 53, but 2019, this needs to be our anthem, I think.
I'll learn every word. I always need a new anthem. My Helen Reddy, I Am Woman, can only take me so far. Again, the what she's singing about and how she's treated, it's that thing of, oh, maybe understand why she's singing that way. And it is that reason of why Taming the Shrew is problematic and why this is the path they have this character take is that she has to acknowledge that she's been in the wrong and that for her to be happy, she needs to succumb to the will of this man in every way, which again, I'm sure this film has, there's people that would know much more about sort of BDSM structure than I do, but there's a whole lot about will and succumbing, following orders. It is the most upsetting to me in this play and in the movie that the final almost romantic gesture from Catherine is she does this entire speech about how not just her job, but women's job is to subjugate for the men. It is to like obey them and to do all of these things. And if this was a fetish thing, great. If that is your kink, do that. But the idea of this beautiful movie with all this money that was shot in 3D in 1953, having this final selling point. And then he swoons because she's come back around and she's making this declaration, not just in the character of Catherine, but also as Lily, the actress, to her former husband, and is saying like, yes, I will obey you. All is right now. Love is back in the world. It's so messed up.
There's so much patriarchy that comes from the actual source material. But then when it turns into the mobster guys show up, which we should probably touch on them at a certain point, Lippy and Slug, Keenan Wynn and James Whitmore, who show up because Tommy Rawls' character has signed Fred's name to his debts. So they come to the play thinking that Fred is really Bill. Because, of course, back in those days, no one actually saw anybody, and they didn't have pictures, so...
And he's also meant to be, like, a famous actor, right? That part was what threw me.
Yeah, he's supposed to be a famous Broadway star, but apparently none of these New York mobsters know. They show up, and it also culminates with Lily saying that she's going to quit to marry Tex, because... through a series of events, she finds out that Fred really isn't in love with her again. He sends some stuff to Lois that ends up going to Lily because shenanigans. She's going to go back to marry her fiance, but then Fred just asserts his masculinity and tells these guys, well, if she leaves, then the show's not going to go on. I'm not going to be able to pay you. And they have to threaten her at gunpoint to stay in the show.
It's hard because I know it is supposed to be with the element of hijinks. We're not actually meant to feel nervous for her. And that's kind of solidified with the end of the gangster's arc. Their boss dies. So they no longer need to collect the money. So they're like, all right.
All's well that ends well. There's just a homicide.
Don't worry. That guy got killed. So you're cool. You're off the hook. Peace out. They also do their own little soft shoe number, which I enjoyed.
Brush up on your Shakespeare is a fantastic performance. This is a movie where two supposed New York gangsters sing a song about Shakespeare.
Don't put gangsters in a box. Kristen, you don't know. New York gangsters might be super into Shakespeare. We don't know.
I do love how they're put in the play itself. I want to see a critic review the play the next day. I want to know where they're just sitting there thinking, the play is horrible. Fred Graham comes off like a pompous pontificating drag queen. And then there's these two guys that look like New York gangsters and conveniently also look like they're on the wanted posters around the corner. And they're in these roles. The leading lady vomits on stage because she ate that day. I don't know. I want to know what Bosley Crowther, whoever the New York Broadway critic would have been, I want to hear his review of the actual Kiss Me, Kate performance within the movie.
That would be good. First off, it was very difficult to discern what was going on because the stage was the size of a football field.
It looks like Grand Central Stadium.
Yeah, it's enormous. I do appreciate the integration of the gangsters into the play and that they become accidental comic relief for the actual play itself because they're bumbling so much. The audience is like, oh, how droll. What great characters. What another layer. I do like that little cheekiness. Every musical, especially, it does need everything tied up with the sweet little bows. So I was fine for them forgiving the debts. It was just ridiculous, though.
I don't know what's more ridiculous. The fact that their boss dies so the debt is forgiven, or the fact that you find out that Lois once went on a date with Tex because Tex shows up, and then Bill gets mad at her and she says that she loves Bill, but she performs a song called Always True to You in My Fashion, where she admits that I love you, but I'm probably gonna see other men.
Okay, I was going to bring that up. Lois's character throughout, and I really would love to know, I have to imagine it was an intentional attempt to balance the scales a bit of the all of the gender horribleness. Because like I said before, how Lois is with Lily and that it's not the trite, competitive female nonsense was already nice. I'm so glad you brought up the song because it is an incredible sex positive, do not slut shame me song. And she's also, Ann Miller is such an incredible, just like light performer. Like she's always smiling. She doesn't look, it's not in that kind of dullard, oh, I'm just smiling my way. Like, and she also doesn't look like she's trying to pull things off. It is just this benevolent, earnest, this is who I am. She's a lovely presence. And this song, it does do a little bit to counteract or to at least interject a different female perspective of, oh no, the kind of woman I am is not only will you not be controlling me in any way, I will be doing what I want and with whom I want, but I'll come back. It's fine. It's fine. You're fine. We're fine. And I kind of dug that.
I do appreciate that this movie doesn't want to give easy answers to relationships that are obviously fraught with issues, Right. But then it also does. So go figure, because the debts are canceled. Lily decides that she's going to go off with Tex. And so Fred is really upset. But then the final act of the play begins.
Before we get to the final act, I just have to remind you, in case it slipped your mind, the number one best visual in this entire movie is when they cut to the outside and you see Lily's fiance, Tex, who of course is a Texas oil man, and he is in some like brand spanking new 1953 Cadillac, and it has one of those longhorns across the top of it in New York City, and it is like an 8 foot wide longhorn attached to this like Cadillac. It is amazing.
Glad you brought that up, because it is the most overt, like, we're not even gonna give him a character. We're literally just gonna present to you as is, and there you go. And you don't really need to care about Tex. He's not Ralph Bellamy or anything like that, you know.
He's not even a Baxter.
He's played by Willard Parker. Does anybody remember who that is?
No. R.I.P. No. Willard Parker.
I'm sorry, Willard Parker. But the final act begins. Lily has left, and it's the finale of the show, but Lily's understudy has disappeared. And Lily shows up in the dress that she was threatened with at gunpoint to wear. And she talks about how women should surrender to their husbands. And Fred is just so overcome. And they have this big Kiss Me Kate, literally, song and kiss. Everybody gets back together, and we culminate with a big 3D Catherine Grayson and Howard Keel coming out of the screen.
So I saw that flat on a laptop and was like, what a weird thing to superimpose at this moment. The 3D part of it makes more sense.
At the end of the movie, when we saw it at the TCM Film Festival and we got 3D Howard Keel, I was just busting.
You love Howard Keel.
All's well that ends well. Howard Keel, I have a love-hate relationship with him because I do feel he always played misogynists. And I don't know if that was indicative of personality or not. I would like to hope not.
I would too, but it actually doesn't surprise me that he would be cast that way because he is very big. He's got that bass voice. It's noticeable even before his looks are. He's really tall and broad. So I can see a lot of men creators projecting their alpha male nonsense onto whatever characters he plays.
So, there were some changes between the original show, obviously, and the play. They had to change some lines. They cut some songs. The "too darn hot" number, they did have to change the line because you couldn't mention. Lois says, according to the latest reports in the movie, it was actually according to the Kinsey report in the musical, which we could not do. And that was really the biggest change, really. But everybody did like this movie. Bosley Crowther, who actually did review it for the New York Times, called it magnificent. And it did make a fair amount of money, but because it had such high production costs, I'm assuming Howard Keel's codpieces were incredibly expensive. It did incur a loss of about $544,000, but it was a success. And it did begin and end the era of 3D in 1953, because by 1954, it hadn't paid off and they ended up not using the gimmick anymore. My biggest criticism of Kiss Me, Kate, is that there is not a comma in the title.
It is almost painful to look if you're staring at it. And I really feel like there is a comma in that prop that I mentioned, the very first one. There was a comma on the alleged book of the play they were doing. It said, "Kiss Me, comma, Kate." My friends had a band in college called Kick Me, Kate, which I love. And they also did not have a comma.
Well, overall, Drea, what do you think about Kiss Me, Kate? Do you recommend it? What are your overall thoughts?
You know, it is nuts. And I do think it's a fun view, though. I think this would be fun to watch with other people. Very clearly, you and I had no problem finding things to talk about. And I do like dissecting gender roles in classic cinema and how they shift and change. And this one is so out there with them. Like, it is not subtle in what it is doing, because there is the lowest stuff in there to sort of balance it out. It's not one of those that I think of as that's just terrible and it's insulting. And I think that this is doing interesting things, and it's such a nutso view. Like, it would be very fun to watch this again, because I feel like I would be constantly pausing and saying, wait, did you see that? Did everyone just see the longhorns on top of his Cadillac? There's so many details in it.
I agree with you. I think this movie is a mess of fun. And I emphasize mess of fun. It does have some really bizarre travels from A to B. But I think that's the joy of 1950s movie musicals.
Yeah.
You know, Bye Bye Birdie has problems. And I love that movie. I think the 1950s musical was just opulent. An emphasis on spectacle and good songs, and Ann Miller is joyous. Howard Keel is definitely good playing a douchebag, and Catherine Grayson's really good. I don't think this is her movie, though. I do feel she gets a bit snowed by the colorfulness of all the other characters. You know, she's still part of a great ensemble, and Tommy Rahl, that tall, lanky man, I love him. He's still with us, by the way. I want him to come to a TCM Classic Film Festival so I can just be like, I love you, man. I know that's weird, but I'm just going
to
say
no,
it.
No, so. I'm sure he would love to hear that. He's probably not getting a lot of fan love these days.
Let us know your thoughts on Kiss Me, Kate, Catherine Grayson, if we should have picked a different movie that you think should have highlighted her talents better. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and we'll read them on the next episode. And that's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can reach me if you want to get in touch with me personally on Twitter @journeys_film. Drea, where are you on social media?
I am on Twitter @TheDreaClark.
And you can listen to Ticklish Business all sorts of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, wherever you get podcasts, or iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, help us out. Leave us a rating and review. And as always, with our questions, comments, suggestions, you can email them directly to us at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films semi-regularly, at journeysinclassicfilm.com. And the podcast is also available on Twitter @ticklish_biz. If you want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. We have a wealth of amazing perks. All your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the classic film podcast that it is. If you become a patron right now, you can listen to my two new supplementary shows, William Bibbiani and I look at how Hollywood talks about itself in cinema with Based on a True Podcast. Our latest episode is looking at the 2001 Jennifer Love Hewitt biopic, The Audrey Hepburn Story. And Adam Kautzer and I do our other show, Doubled Features, looking at the movies Hollywood makes again and again and again. Our recent episode that's available on the podcast right now is looking at The Bad Seed. And we are prepping to talk about Stanley Kubrick and Adrian Lyons' takes on Lolita. There's also my previous interviews with Alan K. Rohde, TCM tour guide Sarah Louise Lilly. I promise we are going to be doing more with Patreon now that we have the new year. I'm hoping Drea and Sam and I are going to have some great ideas coming for Patreon in the future. So that's going to be at patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you're a member of TCM Backlot, you can read my ongoing centennial celebration series where I look at the stars turning 100 in 2019. January star was actress Carol Landis. That's on TCM Backlot. So next time, Drea, you and I, and hopefully Sam, will be back talking about Valentine's Day. We're going to be talking about our top three favorite movie couples.
How do you winnow it down?
As long as it's pre-1970. That's my only caveat. So that will be next episode. And until next time. Bye.